Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. Our topic today is Colette, a biopic of one of France's most notorious literary figures. She was the creator of the smash hit Claudine novels, which caused a stir when they were published at the turn of the 20th century for their depiction of a candid young French girl. However, these stories were released under Colette's husband's name of Willy, which became a source of tension in the couple's marriage. As their success grew, they each embarked on a series of affairs with women, and eventually Colette divorced Willy and went off to be a travelling performer and continued her writing career under her own name. Colette explores sex, gender, money and power, set against the backdrop of late 19th century avant-garde Paris with its opulent salons, poets, mimes and plenty of wine.
You know the new Claudine. Why don't we publish it under both our names?
It's out of the question.
I need my name on the book.
No! We're holding dynamite here. And if it goes off at the wrong time, it could blow our bloody heads off. Right!
You hurt, and you hurt, and you hurt. And you think that by saying that's what men do, you clear it all away. Everything I thought and felt went into those books. They were me.
Join me on the programme today to see if this movie that stars Keira Knightley and Dominic West as Colette and Willy does this star of the French arts justice. It is film critic for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Robey, and film critic and host of the Girls on Film podcast, Anna Smith. Welcome back to the programme and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I think we might have wished you that at an earlier date.
That's true.
In the year.
But once again.
But once again, it's never too late. Or rather it is, but it's fine to do it now. So we've got, I thought, quite a traditional film with lots of untraditional elements in it. Am I striking out in the dark here? Or are we on familiar territory?
I would agree. It's a very surprisingly conventional film about a sort of transgressive character, really. Yeah. On paper, I mean, she really was quite an extraordinary woman. And I thought it was going to be potentially a very racy biopic of an early feminist who had quite an edgy and interesting love life. I mean, all those things are true, but I actually found it almost pedestrian in parts, I have to say. And I think any criticism I say of this film comes, it should be said with the knowledge that I was so excited about this film because on paper it's really my kind of film. So it just didn't go quite as far as I would like it to go. I didn't feel that it necessarily represented the edginess of her real life character in the way that it could have done. Keira Knightley was fantastic, but I just felt that it was perhaps a little bit too conventional. I think there's been other films which have been sort of conventional, like Professor Marston and The Wonder Woman, about these kind of characters that have done a better job. And I just felt at times it was a little bit plodding.
Tim, is this a sheep in sheep's clothing? Because as Anna was saying, the raw material here to go on is interesting, racy. It's very apt to now, but it's played in quite an old-fashioned way.
It is a bit. It's quite a muted piece, I think. One thing is that this film has been long in the planning. The makers of it first wrote the script over 10 years ago. And two things happened, I think, to get it made. One was that they directed Julianne Moore to her Oscar for Still Alice, and this pair of directors, one of whom has now sadly died. But the other thing that happened is I think the current thinking around feminism and also kind of recognition for female creative achievement, all of that has bubbled up and I think given this film the green light, if you like. And it speaks to now. It's silly that it took them this long to make it in a way. It should have come out sooner. And I think the kind of muted element of it, to me, is kind of interesting because, yes, Colette is a trailblazing figure in this story. But also, I think one of the things I valued about the film is that it sort of gives you a flavour of life being lived at that time in a kind of everyday way, almost in a quotidian, like, what was it like to wake up and have breakfast in Belle Epoque Paris kind of thing. So that may not sound desperately thrilling and exciting, but I quite valued it because I thought they'd done a lot of research into that and given it some real texture. So I appreciated things about the film even while acknowledging that perhaps it could have been a bit pacier or more tightly plotted.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, The Favourite is out right now. Mary Queen of Scots is coming, I think it's out next week here in the UK. So there's a lot of period dramas, obviously of different period, but about strong women and about interesting women and about kind of pendulum points in history or crux points in history. This is kind of one of them as well. These Mary Queen of Scots I haven't seen, but certainly the Favourite has got such a kind of weight of kind of wit and wisdom about it. It's quite a stylized piece. I guess you can't, these things come out you don't know when they're going to come out when you're making them even. But does it sit comfortably, do you think, in that triumvirate?
It's very different to The Favourite. The Favourite is much more irreverent and out there. This is more conventional, but I think it's wonderful to see these sort of stories being told. I'd like to think that even though it's probably a coincidence that a few of these films have come out together, and of course it is award season when we're more likely to see these kind of slightly more feminine art house films. But at the same time, I think probably the culture now is a little bit more accepting and open to green lighting, as Tim said, films of this kind of, you know, ilk. Certainly the Time's Up campaign and awareness about women and the role of women in film and the creative arts in general. Although, of course, this has been planned long before that came about, but it certainly helps in the marketing and the promotion of these films. So I think the time is right for it, and I just hope it continues.
Yeah, right. It's a strange one. We'll dive into the good points about this film, of which there are many, not least the performances. Does it feel like a very different film compared to those?
Well,
because they will inevitably be weighed against each other, as you guys will and have done, as much as by the public in this kind of most febrile of seasons for movies.
I mean, I don't think it flatters any film to put up against The Favourite, which is just so, so entertaining and so kind of satirically sharp. But I do think it flatters most films to compare them to Mary Queen of Scots, which I thought was dire, and really like self-serious, fraudulent, and historically on quite dodgy turf. So I think this is much better than that. And I think that the kind of levels to it and the kind of elements of rebellion within Colette's story, her kind of role as a queer icon, not just as a feminist icon, for instance, the plunge into the kind of artistic ferment of the era, the homages to art, music and literature throughout the film, all these things I thought were worth investing in a kind of almost like reading a really good biography for the period.
Yeah, it seemed exactly like that. It had quite a bookish kind of quality to it, which is perhaps why it's very unfavouritish,
and
maybe
thing,
why it's a little unusual.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things, it feels episodic as a story, but I think that's because the Claudine novels, which it definitely is borrowing from, were in themselves episodic. It's like Claudine's in the country, Claudine goes to Paris, Claudine gets married, and those were the names of the books. And in a way, the film has kind of borrowed the structure from that, I think.
So let's talk about the performances. You mentioned that Keira Knightley turns in a stellar performance as Colette, as Claudine. Whichever one you want to take your pick from, how do you weight those two performances, Anna? They're very charming, aren't they? There's a lot going on there.
I thought, Keira, this is possibly one of her best performances ever. I thought she was really in her element, spirited, and she really captured the character. And I have to say, even though I really did enjoy the film, I felt the character could have been written a little bit more thoroughly in terms of the backstory and her development. But Keira brought as much as she possibly could to that role. And I thought she was very likeable in it. And she kind of really balanced that sort of country girl with the wide-eyed in the city with sort of that kind of gradual empowerment, which is really key to this film. And I actually felt that I wanted to see more of her, and I kind of wanted to see a sequel, actually, because it gets up to a point where it's really interesting in her career and then ends. So I'd love that idea if they did it.
And you kind of feel anyone whose mother is Fiona Shaw, it's got to turn out fairly well, right?
Fiona Shaw, amazing, as
good. I wanted to see a bit more of her, actually, as well.
Oh, gosh, yes. I have to say, Dominic West is absolutely brilliant, but it felt slightly against the ideals of the film that there was so much of him in it. You know, it's meant to be about... I know it's about meant to be about him overpowering her in many ways.
Do you mean you're talking about the fat suit that he has to eventually
deploy? Taking up the whole screen. Yeah. No, he's brilliant.
Land grab.
Yeah, yeah. And he always seems to dance on tables in every film now, which I enjoy. I'm very happy to see that.
Holly and I were loving that. We walked out of the cinema and we were like, wasn't it great? Wasn't it great, the scene when Dominic West does this great thing, and it's an ode. It's the one kind of seemingly uncomplicated ode of love to his wife, or rather the character of Claudine. And Holly said, yeah, it's great. It seemed like the film was filmed episodically, and by that point they were really all getting on with each other.
Claudine, she is a Midas minx. Her smile mysterious like a sphinx. She walks, she talks, she even thinks. Claudine, Claudine, Claudine. Claudine's a girl who knows no bounds. A fox that can't be caught by hounds. Exploding star that makes no sound.
Claudine, Claudine, Claudine.
Who is this girl in my heart?
Claudine.
Who is me right from the start?
Claudine.
Who is a bit of a tart?
Claudine,
Claudine, Claudine,
Claudine.
Who is the girl I admire?
Claudine.
Who is the queen of desire?
Claudine.
Who is Sir Paris on fire?
It had a bit of that to it, didn't it?
I get that. Yeah, I think it's important as well that Willie is presented as quite a shaded character. Obviously, he's a monster in some ways, but I think Dominic West finds a seam of sympathy in him. He's quite sad. He's quite a tragic figure by the end. And I think if you didn't like buy into his charm and his kind of vivacity, you wouldn't understand what she ever saw in him, which is a big problem. I mean, it reminds me of the problem with Kira's role in Anna Karenina, which is that she's stuck with Aaron Taylor-Johnson. You're like, why have you gone off with this twit? Because that role was so badly written and cast. And here I think there's real dimension to the husband, even when he's at his worst. There's something desperate and quite tragic about him. So I thought he really came good with that. And as far as Kira goes, I like her in it a lot. And I like how she's playing a bit with her kind of tomboy style, which she's always had from the very beginning of her career.
Yeah, from Bend It Like Beckham.
Bend It Like Beckham has got the whole plot where, are they lesbians, you know? Yeah. And she's kind of playing with that, and she's matured into a way to play with that with a character who's kind of much more mature. And I think she's kind of in control of it, and yeah, I really enjoyed watching her. The stuff where she goes, treads the boards and does this kind of vampish performance art is really fun as well, I think.
Yeah, and it is, and it's strange seeing an actor. It's always that funny thing of seeing an actor playing a role where the person in the role, it goes off and does something unfamiliar, like acting. Trying to see them act worse, but as an actor, I don't know. I mean, it's a bit like one of those mirror images where you keep on seeing the thing down the line. I know you interviewed Dominic West, Tim. I read an interview with him recently which had Keira Knightley quoted in it saying, the thing about him is that even when he's supposed to be a dickhead, is something kind of sexy and kind of good about his characters, I suppose. Is that an element of watchability? I think you interviewed him for the Telegraph for this, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, that's right. And he admitted that these days he mainly just gets to play these assholes, as he put it, with the exception of Les Miserables at the moment on TV, when he's playing the great hero of world literature. But I think early on in his career, he was the guy who kind of was the party animal in the first reel of a film in Chicago in 28 Days. And you had to kind of get rid of him in a way for the film to carry on. And now I'm really pleased he got this role, because I feel as though it could easily have gone to someone else. It's, you know, he wouldn't necessarily be the first person you'd think of to put in this part, but he actually does a really grand job in it. And he really just helps the film reach a sort of level of nuance that it might have lacked otherwise. It could have been very point-scoringly kind of yay feminism in a way that might have been a little bit kind of cheap. And I think he renders it richer and a bit more real.
And on that note, Anna, about there is a lot of Dominic West in the film, considering it's called Colette. It's about the character and about the woman that was his, about the writer, the real power behind the throne kind of thing, and their literary relationship. It's a funny one, isn't it? You kind of needed the seesaw of their marriage and their relationship and his selfishness and then her kind of, and her selflessness, but then her, I don't know, it's a fun, how do you measure that in terms of screen time? It's a funny
one. It is tricky, and I think Tim and you are both absolutely right that we do need to have that grey area in their relationship and to understand that it's very complex and he's not necessarily just the bad guy and, you know, the boo-hiss panto villain, and I think that's really important. I just think there was probably a few scenes more on him than we needed, because I still felt that we were slightly rushing through elements of Colette's life, and in particular her relationship with Missy, who played by Denise Goff, who is a gender non-conforming character. And I'm a big one for romance. Suddenly these two seem to be in a relationship, and I don't even know how they fell for each other. I didn't really see...
The two girls.
Yeah. Yes. Or whatever you want to call Missy's character.
She uses both he and her pronouns.
That's right. Yes. Exactly. I kind of thought that was interesting. I wonder whether that was also a pronoun of the time, or whether that was a pronoun that's been put on it by the writers.
Well, in her writing, I think she or he used both, as Tim says, but also referred to herself as Uncle Max or Missy, depending, and, you know, dressed in various different ways. So really interesting. I mean, I interviewed Denise Goff actually for Time Out, and she said there was no way of knowing whether she was at the forefront of the butch lesbian movement or the front of the trans movement, because obviously those words were not bandied around then. But it's interesting, and they've obviously gone to a great deal of trouble to try to get as accurate as possible and to be as sensitive as possible to contemporary interpretations of that. And Denise was saying that she spoke to people, you know, experts about assigning contemporary sexual identities to historical figures, and they did get into some trouble for casting a woman in that role, and all that's really interesting. But at the same time, I wanted to see more of that relationship. I felt too much of Dominic West, great as he is.
No, okay. No, it's very, like, it's really interesting, actually, as well, because she was only allowed to be that person because she was part of high society and could get away with it because she was called eccentric rather than being sort of challenging, because wasn't she descended from Josephine and the Tsar of Russia, so she was allowed to kind of do whatever she wanted kind of thing.
Yeah, she was
there's
an
something
aristocrat.
About that
yeah.
about it as well, which is kind of
and they sort of refer to that entitlement, and she's very open about that. I think she probably would have got arrested for wearing trousers otherwise, you know, had she not been so moneyed and titled.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. It's kind of fascinating.
And it's funny, maybe one of the most shocking scenes is when Colette turns up to visit Willie. They've been living apart. She's been living with Missy. And then she turns up in a suit and looks great. You know, I mean, kind of Diane Keaton, eat your heart out, right? It looked really great. And that seemed to be, that was kind of the most shocking scene where you see her walk down the street, you see her walk up the stairs and you think there's nothing wrong until she has to confront her husband. There are some nice moments in this which don't seem over-egged. Maybe it's the musical score, maybe it's the way in which it was directed and written, but it doesn't seem like it's hammering home its points, if indeed it's trying to make any. Is that fair? I don't know. Maybe it's just, as I say, the general vibe of the film.
I think that's fair. I think it wants to convey a kind of accurate flavour of her kind of life as it was being lived through those years without forcing too many points. And so many biopics really push things too much. Mary Queen of Scots is a good example, inventing whole things that remotely didn't happen. Mm. Something like The Imitation Game, sort of twisting the story away from the uncomfortable areas because it wants to kind of achieve a certain awardsy, prestige-y arc to it. And I really valued the film, that the ways in which this film didn't do that. And if it did cause it to be a little bit flatter as drama, I'm kind of willing to take the trade because I think it's less cheap. So I valued all that. I would also have liked to have seen more of Denise Gough, I agree. I think that role was interesting and we only got a sort of almost like trailer moments of what that character could have been, I think, within the film. Interestingly, they've cast other trans actors around in the movie in different roles, but just not in that one. And again, you know, this woman couldn't possibly have identified as trans because the term didn't exist. So who would you actually correctly cast in that role? It's hard to see, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if it's easier doing films that are about, this is obviously an historical film. It's also based on a literary character who's based that character on her own life. So there's all sorts of layers of interest and meaning to it. The gender fluidity and sexual fluidity thing, is it maybe easier to set it in a historical context and maybe do a film about it now? That you can, it is easier before filmmakers have defined their own language about what is now to be able to set it in the past and not get away with it, but get used to the terms and the feeling of making a film about this. Although this is also about authorship, female, all sorts of other things.
It is a really complex question. I think there are pros and minuses to filming it in the past and to setting that kind of story in the past. It's very easy to sort of start using our contemporary judgment on the past. And perhaps by setting it in the past, you're almost setting yourself up for that, though, as well as dodging some bullets.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can't really win at the moment with these kind of trans arguments, I think, as filmmakers. It is really difficult. You know, Denise Gough was saying, well, surely I should be able to play something that I'm not. Otherwise, I'm just going to play an Irish woman for the rest of my life. And there aren't many roles for that, you know. So where do you draw the line? And it is tricky. But I understood they did a very open casting process and looked at lots of trans actors for that.
OK, so this was a film directed by Wash Westmoreland. I'm relatively unfamiliar with him. Tim, you mentioned that it was originally going to be a co-directed piece.
So he and his husband and writing directing partner Richard Glatzer were kind of leading lights in the kind of new queer cinema in the 90s, and they made a number of films back then. They made a film called Quinceañera, which came out in the like 2004-ish, and then they had a real success with Still Alice, which was the final film that Richard Glatzer was able to make before he died of ALS. And Julianne Moore, of course, won her Oscar playing, in fact, a character with a related disorder, because the kind of oblivion that she's suffering in that film is neurologically related to ALS. So there was a kind of weird empathy going on in that production, I think. And in fact, she won her Oscar, you know, weeks before Richard died. He was able to see it from his hospital bed. This is Wash's first solo project since then. And certainly it's given him a kind of budgetary boost in order to get it made and attract these stars. So I'm pleased to sort of kind of see him going ahead on his own. He's got another film coming up, I think, he's making in Japan is the next one.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to cogitate on Colette by the aid of two bits of further reading. Anna, you mentioned the wife in relation to this. I can definitely see why. But talk us through this one, if you will.
So the wife, Glenn Close, recently, of course, won a Golden Globe for her performance in The Wife. It's the story of, ostensibly, Jonathan Pryce, who is about to collect a Nobel Prize for his writing, and many decades worth of authorship. And Glenn Close plays the wife, who goes to collect it with him. And it follows them over a few days of kind of increasingly agonising interactions as he gets a great deal of adulation. And we delve back into their past with flashbacks, actually starring Glenn Close's daughter, where we discover perhaps the element to which she influenced his career, supporting supported his career. And it was really, without giving too much away, about how women often sacrifice a great deal for their husbands, and in particular, women like this who had a great deal of own artistic talent, but who decided to take a back seat, perhaps because economic reasons or other patriarchal reasons dictated that they were the caregivers and the home givers.
I really enjoyed this movie. It wasn't universally loved, I don't think, but I thought it was a great one. And as you say, it's an interesting one. It's ostensibly about Jonathan Pryce. He's kind of a muscular 60s male writer. I mean, he's a bit of an Updike kind of character, right? Who gets his comeuppance at the Nobel Prize for Literature ceremony and the trip that surrounds that, the trip to Sweden, which is all very kind of well-mannered and yes, sir, three bags full, sir. I thought this was an amazing thing, and Glenn Close was incredible in it, and the kind of how she's actually seen. But it's the first time I've seen her do anything for yonks, and then suddenly coming back and doing this was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, again, she's always fantastic, yeah. But I think this could be her big, big moment. As she said at the Golden Globes, she's been doing it 45 years. She gave a great speech, which I think is setting her up for BAFTAs and Oscars, potentially, sort of talking about exactly what we were just saying, the themes of the movie and reflecting on them and how women often take a back seat, which is obviously very timely. And she is amazing. You just see every flicker of emotion going through her eyes. And it's based on a novel which is kind of narrated by her character, but actually they dispense with the narration in the film, which I think is a smart move because she's such an expressive performer. And you see so much going through her face, just tiny little minute twitches, whether it's affection or jealousy or pride or bittersweet resentment. There's so much going on. She's amazing.
I love her performance in this film. There's one moment that really stuck out for me when they arrive in Stockholm, isn't it, for the Nobel Prize. And Jonathan Pryce is introducing her around and says, oh, this is my wife. She doesn't write. And the camera just rests on Glenn's closest face, which hardly moves, but the temperature in it somehow just drops 2,000 degrees. And the point being that she has written everything. I was really struck when I saw, and that's kind of a spoiler, I guess. But,
sorry,
but
I pulled the spoiler really, face then.
You did. Don't tell them!
Anna, no spoiler.
Sorry.
It's okay.
But the point is, the reason we've
I think it's been out
up,
for long enough.
Has,
to,
yeah. And yeah, people, she's winning awards now. I think people know what the story is a little bit. But the similarities with this story are so extraordinary for them, these two films to be coming out at the same time, because spoil Colette a little bit more perhaps, but you know, the misapplied acclaim, the male writer getting all the credit for what the wife, who's the real kind of brains behind the operation, has been achieving. I thought that parallel was really sort of striking, almost bizarre that these films
yeah,
come out at the same
time.
Yeah,
me too. I thought that as well. I loved that film. I thought it was amazing. And also, and on the Dominic West scale, Jonathan Pryce's role is fairly dufferish throughout, isn't it?
He's
not exactly... I mean, he's not... Or awful, but he turns out to be, it seems.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting character journey that he goes on, because there is something very genuine nice about him, but he is very susceptible to flattery. And as he becomes more of a celebrity figure, you see the cracks showing. So yeah, it's great. Yeah. I love this film.
Yeah. It is The Wife, as recommended by Anna Smith. Tim, you wanted to talk about the music from Colette by Thomas Adès?
Adès, yes. Yeah. Very well-known opera composer, who makes his first foray into film scoring with this film, and I really enjoyed his score. It has a lot of variety to it. There's some sort of really plush, kind of verdant stuff when she's running
some proper romantic
fields.
French music,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But then there's some really quiet, sort of thoughtful passages in it as well. He's, I think, a very interesting figure, and he's clearly approached it to write a period-specific score. He's chosen instruments that were being used in French salon music at the time. There are scenes where you sort of see performance going on, and he's contributed to the orchestration of that. He's borrowed from some of those composers from the turn of the century. But he's also decided to write a score which kind of brings you up to the very edge, I think, of the like modernist era for music. So when you enter these contemplative passages in the score, which I particularly liked, they're sort of nudging at the vanguard a little bit, which is exactly what Colette's doing. It's a very intelligent piece of music, which I think stands up quite well on its own.
We're going to have a little clip of Thomas Adès's for Colette. This is called Vals du Salon. Yeah, there's something very romantic and sort of Sanson about it, right up to sort of Poulenc and things like this. It's a real, it was beautiful.
Yeah, I was thinking about Poulenc as well, yeah.
And also used in this kind of very, it's like watching at times sort of like a Renoir or something. There is detail, but there's impressionism in it. There's a lot of, as I said to Holly, a lot of kind of at the beginning anyway, Keira Knightley running schoolgirlishly through beautiful sort of flower meadows, and then it kind of gets quite real and the score changes, as it should, obviously. But it was a kind of stark thing to notice in the movie, actually.
Yeah, and it matches some of the kind of visual ornamentation in the film. You know, there's a scene where we walk through a park and it is very nicely styled, like Suraz Sunday in the Park with George, without kind of flashing neon lights at you to say that's what it's doing.
Yeah.
You just got that quite kind of intuitively, I think. And the music matches that. There's something... It's hard to pin down what makes a piece of music sound like post-impressionist or like sound like it should match that scene, but he has achieved it, I think.
Much to chew over in Colette, which I think we all three around the table enjoyed. That brings us to the end of the Monocle Culture Show. Colette is out in cinemas now. Thank you to my guests, Tim Robey and Anna Smith, and of course to my producer, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week when I'll be giving the new record by Sharon Van Etten a spin. But until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.